Many history books portray the United States as a heroic country, a force for good in a chaotic and dangerous world. As we saw in the last election, politicians from both parties support the idea of American exceptionalism. Filmmaker Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick have teamed up to challenge that narrative in their Showtime documentary series and an accompanying book called The Untold History of the United States. It's published by Gallery Books. What they call A People's History of the American Empire reveals a darker side of our country's past. Mr. Stone is the director of hit films like Wall Street and JFK, and he's won Oscars for Platoon and Born on the 4th of July. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Mr. Kuznick is a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Hello, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you,
Larry. Oliver, you've often dealt with history in your films. What's prompted your focus on documentaries during the past decade?
Well, it's a culmination of themes in the films that I've done where some they've touched on contemporary events, whether it's Central America, Vietnam, or the economy, or football, or presidents. I'm interested in my time. I'm participating in it, and I can call. I'm trying to understand it, and
And you could do that better with documentaries than
well,
in story films.
My life has changed. I'm not who I was when I started. I grew up in a conservative environment in New York City with Republican father, support very much an Eisenhower Republican, and I went to Vietnam. I served over there, and I went on in my life and traveled, made movies, saw things, and each time I'd go closer to a subject like Central America, for example, Salvador brought me into that Central American conflict with Ronald Reagan was putting on the pressure. I saw American soldiers repeating some of the experiences I saw in Vietnam, and you re-experience something, you realize something. So what I'm saying is in all these films, I dealt with individual subject matter, like the Kennedy assassination or Nixon. But finally, with the George Bush administration, I felt like I had to do something for the next generation, for my children, because in history books that they get in school, they are not getting anything close to this story.
You narrate the TV documentaries.
I have to say, reluctantly, it wasn't my choice. It was because I laid down the guide tracks and I was ready to hire an actor. And I just, not to misunderstand it, it was everyone who was around me, the whole editing staff, that said the voice was working for.
But it also allows you to talk about the education you and your children received,
right?
Which you think was inaccurate.
It is, unfortunately. I mean, it does have many things right, there's partial truth in some of it, but it does emphasize America's interest primarily. It sees the world through American eyes only, and it's very arrogant and based in hubris of the concept of we have goodness on our side, we have exceptionalism, as you call it, we also have the right on our side. And basically what people don't acknowledge is that we have the bomb on our side when we're the first ones who dropped it. And that gave us it confirmed our infallibility.
And you say that the turning point for you was when you were a soldier in Vietnam?
No, that would be the conventional narrative. Truthfully, I came back from Vietnam. I was not having a St. Paul and Damascus moment or anything like that. It did take many more years of listening to people and feeling my way through the experience. And I think the Ronald Reagan years were very important in America. I never saw it coming, and I think it moved the country very strictly to the right. And he has affected Democrats and Republicans alike.
Professor Kuznick, was there a turning point for you?
No, I've got a different kind of trajectory. Oliver comes from a conservative Republican family. I came from a liberal family, and my parents were involved in progressive activities. My mom was active in civil rights and anti-war movement. I was active in civil rights very young. I joined the NAACP when I was 12, Congress of Racial Equality when I was 13, became an anti-war activist even before classes started in college. And so I didn't have a turning point. The interesting thing for me is the way in which Oliver's evolution converged with my evolution. And I saw that in his films. I began teaching a course called Oliver Stone's America based on Oliver's films, and we tied that in with works by historical scholars and participants in all the key events. And I was seeing moments of clarity and truth and really radical analysis in Oliver's films from a very early time. So even back in the 1980s when he was making films like Salvador, he's presenting more of this kind of progressive, challenging narrative in his films, that in Wall Street and JFK, than you see in anybody else's Hollywood films that I'm aware of.
How did you come together?
Well, Oliver.
Yeah, go ahead. You want to do it quickly, though, Peter, because
yes,
this
Oliver,
is radio.
Oliver came to my class in 1996, the first time I taught it. And afterwards, we went out to dinner, and we started to talk about history. And I laid out some things for him about Henry Wallace and how close Wallace came to the presidency and how that ties in with the decision to drop the bomb. And that led to us beginning to talk about these kinds of issues. And later, years later, we decided we're going to make the documentary.
And your original idea was to call the series Secret History rather than The Untold History?
Yeah, we floated around with several titles, but it wasn't really a secret history. You know,
People know these stories.
Well, they've forgotten them. A lot of them have forgotten them or ignored them. These have been in headlines at times. But frankly, you know, in my daughter's school book, when she goes to a private school, very good one, pay a lot of money for it. It's a good book in many ways, good pictures and all that, and easy to read, by the way. But Hiroshima, the dropping of the bomb is necessary because the Japanese are fanatics and we had to save American lives, which is the story that has been used, the official story, since the beginning of that.
To avoid
American land invasion of Japan. Peter has gone to great pains to document why that is not true. Peter, if you want to.
Yeah. This is the subject of the first show in the series. But it's not true that American troops were going to be forced to invade Japan at the cost of hundreds of thousands of
lives. That's what you hear. Peter, why don't you quickly deal with that, if you can?
That's the mythology. And that was said by Stimson when he wrote about this after the war, and Truman later repeated that over and over again. But by that point, the Japanese were defeated. In fact, the Japanese recognized they were defeated in July of 1944 after the Battle of Saipan. And by February 1945, Prince Konoe, who was a former prime minister, wrote to the emperor saying, defeat is inevitable. We've got to reconcile with that. What we have to try to prevent is a communist takeover. The Japanese knew they were defeated. The Americans knew the Japanese were defeated. Truman, with the United States, had broken the Japanese codes before the war. Truman refers to the July 18th intercepted telegram as a telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. Truman says what the American intelligence and political officials understood was the thing that the Japanese dreaded the most was the Soviet Union coming into the war on the United States side. And Truman went to Potsdam, and Stalin agreed he's going to follow through his promise to Roosevelt and come into the war in early August.
So why didn't they surrender sooner? In fact, they didn't surrender immediately after the dropping of the first bomb.
No, the bomb was not what made the difference. The United States had already been firebombing 100 Japanese cities. We've been wiping out cities, city after city. We wiped out 99.5% of the city of Toyama. The difference to the Japanese was not that we could wipe out cities, whether it was 200 planes and thousands of bombs or one plane and one bomb. That was not the big difference. The big difference was the Soviet invasion. The Japanese strategy had been twofold. One, to negotiate through the Russians, try to get them to get better surrender terms for Japan. And secondly, the Ketsugo strategy was to welcome an American invasion and inflict heavy casualties on the Americans, and that would also try to get them better surrender terms. The Soviet invasion undermines both their military strategy and their diplomatic strategy. The Soviets invade August 9th in Manchuria and elsewhere, and they completely overwhelm the Kwantung Army. Prime Minister Suzuki, when he was asked, why do we have to surrender now? He said, the Soviets are already in Karafuto, Hokkaido. They'll soon be on the mainland of Japan. We have to surrender now. We can still surrender to the Americans, because they thought they would have a much better chance of retaining the emperor through the United States than they would through the Soviets.
And they were right, actually. Yes. But you also, Oliver, you mentioned Henry Wallace earlier. Henry Wallace had been FDR's first vice president, but he was replaced by Harry Truman. And are you suggesting that history would have been totally different
if he had been
the vice president when FDR died?
We're very strongly, of course, we're jumping in a few seconds here to talk about something that we will lay out in detail, but we go into his background.
We only have less than a half hour to talk about a series that runs how many shows?
10 shows, 10 hours, and a book that runs 700
and
pages.
And we should point out that the 10-part documentary series airs Monday nights at 8 p.m. on Showtime. The first chapter aired this past Monday.
And the second one on Monday next. And I guess you can catch up through the Showtime anytime, DirecTV.
But after you watch Homeland.
Yes, that is a good link. But the Wallace is a great character. He's very much like a Jimmy Stewart in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
And you have a clip from
We
Frank
show a
Capra's
clip of that, and we show his words, Wallace's speeches, the way he thought. But we tie him into the bigger narrative of World War II, which is a much different war than the one many Americans think we fought. The Soviets play a huge role in winning it. They are the dominant factor. And with also the role of the British Empire, Churchill's true objectives are brought out in this World War II episode. And it's a fascinating game of geopolitics, strategy, gambling between Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill.
Well, but Roosevelt dumped him because he felt that Wallace was too leftist, didn't he?
Just to say about the top three there, I mean, that story has never really been told in this way. And Wallace is a key figure because he was the third vice president, and he was also agricultural secretary during the New Deal. He did a tremendous amount of good with agriculture. He was a good man, and he was and Roosevelt loved him. And in 1944, he was the popular favorite by far. 65% of the Democratic voters wanted him to be vice president, and they knew Roosevelt was sick. And only 2% really liked Harry Truman. And it's a corrupt scandal behind the scenes. In those days, the party bosses ran the conventions much more so than they do now. And Truman was snuck in really in an underhanded way.
Well, Peter, you say that the Cold War would have been avoided.
Yeah,
we
think so. It's a speculative
but
history.
Stalin was already controlled all of Eastern Europe. And
that's what he wanted, because he wanted a buffer zone between himself and Germany. The Russians had been invaded twice through Eastern Europe by Germany. And
Roosevelt
understood
that, and Roosevelt made a deal with him and said, I understand that you will have governments that are favorable to the Soviet Union, not hard communists, and that was the deal. And that's the way it was. Stalin kept his word in all these countries, possible with small exceptions in East Germany because they hated the Germans so much for the brutalities that had been visited on them. But in this case, it was Truman who brings the pressure to bear on the Soviets from day one. Well, dropping the bomb in itself is a very hostile action. If you as the Soviets know that you're not really need, you don't have to finish off the Japanese, and they could finish them off in a few weeks. They really could. Why would you give me the message
to the
world? And on top
of
that, you're leaving your bases all around Russia, all around, and you have the bomb. You're encircling Russia right away. It's like them putting troops in Canada and Mexico. And what happens in a series of meetings we detail is Truman does not handle the situation with the diplomatic finesse of Roosevelt.
I guess I would feel a lot more sympathetic to Stalin if he hadn't killed millions of people.
That's true. That's hard to buy
And that would suggest that we would have had the Cold War no matter what, because he did have this strong expansionist sensibility on top of...
The difference between Stalin and Trotsky, his big enemy, was that Trotsky believed in permanent worldwide revolution. Stalin believed in socialism in one country. That was the big split there. And Stalin was very much of a Russian nationalist. He was concerned about Russian defense. And if you look at the comments by America's leaders like Secretary of War Henry Stimson and other key cabinet officials, including General Marshall, they say the Russians are sticking to their agreements, and sometimes they're exceeding their agreements in our favor, and that they're not expansionist in that way. We have to understand why they're so defensive. Why they are so concerned about their security. And Stimson says they probably have a much better understanding of their real security than we do. There's a split among Truman's advisors. The change is from Roosevelt, whose last cables were making very clear that we're going to be able to collaborate with the Russians in the future and preserve the peace, to Truman. Truman gets in there with no background. He'd been vice president for 82 days. During that time, he'd met with Roosevelt twice. He didn't know any of the agreements that were made, and that's why people were very concerned in the cabinet. They said, we have to watch who he's talking to because he's going to be so easily influenced. And who did he talk to? Stettinius, Jimmy Burns, all the anti-Soviet hardliners. And what you see is within the first 2 weeks of that administration, we go from having a friendly relationship with the Russians to the April 23rd meeting when Molotov comes and Truman says, I gave it to him 1-2 to the jaw. I told him where to get on and where to get off, basically.
This is very hard for many Americans to understand because they grew up thinking the Russians, I heard it when I was a kid. My father was saying the Russians are taking over the world, international communism. All the evidence
the
that
evil
we
empire.
Found is that he was not an internationalist and he had a very primitive understanding of, he was a nationalist and he was a czar in Russia. And he was cruel, as Russian czars have been, but he was also kept to his agreements. And Churchill said that before he died. Churchill said he stuck to his word.
My guests are Oliver Stone, the filmmaker, and Peter Kusnick, professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. They have collaborated on a 10-part documentary series, The Untold History of the United States, that airs Monday nights at 8 p.m. on Showtime. And there's also a companion book called by the same title. It is published by Gallery Books. Has lots of pictures in it as
well. No, Simon & Schuster in the States.
I have the English version here.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's British.
Is that why labor is spelled with a U in this?
I guess so.
One of the issues that you address here is the whole concept of American exceptionalism, and I mentioned in my introduction that during the last campaign, almost everybody said made sure they defended themselves against charges against not believing in American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. You think that that's at the core of many of our problems?
I think that we, in the dropping of the bomb, for the reasons that we did, it's a shame and a disgrace, and I think we have to deny it. In denying it to ourselves, we deny the origin myth that we hurt people. We consider ourselves good. We always have since the Puritans got here. We consider ourselves the right, and they're interchangeable. What's good is right, and what right is good, and it's all backed at the end of the day by superiority of the bomb and our ability, by the way, to use it to drop it. We were the only ones to drop it. We made nuclear threats several times, 7 or 8 times since then, maybe more.
A lot more than that. But 12 times.
Although Truman fired MacArthur for wanting to drop the bomb.
Yes, that's...
And it's interesting because MacArthur was such a strong critic of the original dropping.
Yeah, let's stick to the major point, which is exceptionalism, which is as time goes by, and we find all these false intelligences that are passed on to the public about American inferiority, underdogs to the Russians, never at one time. Ever do we slip? We have the monopoly for 4 years on the bomb. We continue to develop nuclear weapons. Eisenhower builds up the greatest stable of nuclear weapons ever, up to about 30,000 that he was budgeted for. 30,000 nuclear weapons. And we carry this through. And then all these election-type tensions that rise about how we are lagging behind the Soviets are just not borne out by the truth. Kennedy comes in, McNamara does an inventory, he finds that there is no missile gap. Happens constantly. Reagan warrant says that the Soviets are ahead of us in every military detail capacity. He says that, and he's lying. And this goes on through right today. So we go from the atomic bomb to the H-bomb to drone missiles, to the highest technology, computer warfare, cyber warfare, and I want to say space warfare. And that's a very important thing that's coming up now. This is Obama is implementing space frontier, electronic warfare on the frontier of space, and no other nation in the world backs this. There's been 166-1 vote in the UN in 2006 trying to demilitarize space, and we have not. We're the outlier here. That's exceptionalism. And here's Obama the other night, I'm sorry to go on, saying that we are the indispensable nation. You buy that, then you belong,
Don't you see contradictions all along? You mentioned that Eisenhower built up our nuclear, all of our nuclear armaments, and at the same time, he warned against the military-industrial complex.
But he was the main person in building
beautiful.
Up the
that's
military-industrial
life.
Complex.
And then during this most recent campaign, you're being critical of President Obama, but Mitt Romney said that he was going to cut back on military spending.
But he doesn't. He may cut back here, but he's certainly going to build up this force that he talks about in China against China, which is a containment policy.
He's promised repeatedly not to cut about the force in Asia, and we're going to shift 60% of our fleet to the Pacific front.
It never changes. The dance never changes. The military budget grows and grows and grows, and we sit there passively. It's like a mushroom that never ends. And why? We're so bloated. We're so armed beyond past our protecting ourselves. What we are is we're making it offensive, and we're taking over the role of a global military enforcer.
Well,
it's no longer a national security state. It's a global security state.
You say that one of the other things we deny is that we are an empire. The United States has been an empire, and it was interesting that the British historian, the conservative British historian Neil Ferguson, said the United States is an empire, and it should be proud of it.
Yeah.
Because
the neoconservatives say that, yes.
And the New York Times had a front page cover article in the Times Magazine, January 5th, 2003, titled American Empire, Get Used to It. So the neocons started to admit to the fact that we had an empire. Then they started to brag about the fact that we had an empire.
Yeah.
This is something that they in the past would not even have admitted to.
Now, in concluding your book, you write, "The real hope for changing the United States lies in U.S. citizens joining with the rebellious masses everywhere to deploy the lessons of history." Do you really think that's likely?
Leonard, you're cynical. We show in our series over those 10 hours pivotal points where there's hope for change, and it almost happens, and sometimes it doesn't. It's like getting into the batter's box, and sometimes we strike out, but we may get back in the box. Look at the Wallace moment in 44. Look at the Stalin dies in 53. There's an offer of peace from the Soviets that Eisenhower and Dulles do not take. There's a moment with Kennedy after the missile crisis. Beautiful moment with Khrushchev. Great moments and possibilities. In 1989, when Bush Sr., the Bush 41 comes into office, Gorbachev is there offering him the deal of a lifetime. And they're going to take all the troops out of Eastern Europe at this point.
And
Bush responds by going to war in Panama and Iraq won. You know, it's all these signals are broken. Obama was a great moment.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I thought Al Gore was a good moment, too. I thought it was a possibility of economic climate attention, you know.
But you're also suggesting that people may very well have certain idealism, and then when the time comes and they become president of the United States, then they become the president of the United States.
Well, what does that mean? You turn your back on all you believe, the principles, like in a Mr. Smith Goes to Washington? No, you can't do that. You have to believe, because presidents have done good things. Obama has done some good things.
The part of the problem with Obama is that we didn't keep the pressure on him. He had said, if you want me to do the right things, you're going to have to force me to do it. And that's why we're talking about a global upsurge. We're seeing this in Latin America. We're seeing this in Asia. We're seeing signs of it in Africa. We're seeing it in the United States. The Occupy movement was just a hint. What happens in Tunisia? A 26-year-old street vendor burns himself to death in protest, and it sparks this movement throughout the Middle East.
We're running out of time. Do you think things are going to change in the second term?
We hope so. We think it's possible. We saw a dramatic change in Kennedy.
Well, I know he watches. I know the president watches Homeland. Maybe he'll watch your series as well. Oliver Stone has his films have won numerous Academy Awards. Peter Kuznick is professor of history and director of the award-winning Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Their film, their documentary series, and their book, The Untold History of the United States. Thank you both so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Leonard. I appreciate it.